I used to believe that once something became official, it would have weight. That if a situation crossed the invisible line from rumor into process, it would have to be handled with care. I thought investigations were heavy things. That they bent systems, slowed momentum, forced truth into the open. What I learned instead is that investigations can be light. They can be designed to look serious without ever threatening the shape of power. They can move fast enough to exhaust you, and slow enough to bury what matters. When HR told me they were launching a full internal review, I felt a brief, shameful relief. I told myself this was the moment where the story would stop being distorted by who said it loudest. I told myself that facts would matter more than rank. I told myself that whatever happened next, I would at least be able to stand inside it honestly. They interviewed everyone. They took notes. They asked careful questions. They thanked me for my courage. And then, they chose the version of events that caused the least disruption. Nothing exploded. Nothing was corrected. Careers advanced. I stayed. And from that point on, safety became something I remembered, not something I had. I had been at the company for nearly 5 years when it happened, long enough to understand its rhythms and its hypocrisies. We were a mid-sized technology firm in Sudden, Germany, proud of our international clients and our clean internal language. We spoke constantly about transparency, about ethics, about doing things the right way. Posters about compliance lined the hallways. Workshops were mandatory. We were encouraged to speak up early, before issues hardened into problems. I wasn't junior anymore, but I wasn't protected either. I sat in that middle space where you are visible enough to be useful and expendable enough to be ignored. My role put me in regular contact with senior leadership, especially during quarterly reviews and product launches. I knew how decisions were really made. I knew which voices mattered and which ones were tolerated. The man at the center of it all had been with the company since its early growth phase. He wasn't a CEO, but he might as well have been in terms of influence. He controlled resources, timelines, and reputations. People deferred to him instinctively. His calendar dictated everyone else's urgency. He had a way of framing his opinions as inevitabilities rather than choices. At first, my interactions with him felt flattering. He noticed my work. He pulled me into conversations that were technically above my pay grade. I told myself I was earning trust. I ignored the way meetings with him always drifted slightly off agenda. I ignored how he tested boundaries with humor that could always be dismissed as cultural misunderstanding or personality. The first warning sign came quietly. A comment made too casually about my appearance during a project review. Not explicit, not crude, but unnecessary. I laughed it off because that's what women learn to do when the alternative feels heavier. The second came in the form of a late-night message about a presentation that didn't need to happen until the following week. I responded professionally and immediately because responsiveness was rewarded. Over time, these moments accumulated. Nothing dramatic enough to point to, nothing that would stand alone as proof, just a steady erosion of clarity. I started adjusting my schedule to avoid being alone with him. I started copying others on emails that didn't require it. I started rehearsing neutral expressions in my head before meetings. I told myself this was normal. I told myself I was being sensitive. I told myself that ambition always came with discomfort. What finally broke that internal negotiation was an incident that happened during an off-site strategy session. We were staying at a conference hotel, the kind designed to blur work and rest, just enough to keep people accessible. After dinner, he suggested we review a document together in the lounge. It sounded reasonable. It sounded professional. When I arrived, he was already there, drink in hand, relaxed in a way that made my posture tighten. The conversation shifted quickly. Not to anything explicit, but to territory that made it clear he was no longer speaking as a colleague. When I redirected, he left. When I stood to leave, he reached out, not aggressively, but deliberately, as if testing how much resistance the moment would allow. I left without making a scene. I spent the rest of the night shaking in my room, replaying every second, wondering how I would ever explain something that felt so obvious to me and so deniable on paper. The next morning, I performed. I smiled. I contributed. I watched him behave impeccably in front of others. That contrasted something to me. It made the experience feel unreal, as if it only existed because I had been alone with it. When I finally spoke to HR, weeks later, I framed it carefully. I used their language. I focused on impact, not intent. I was precise. I thought precision would protect me. The moment HR confirmed they were opening an investigation, the atmosphere around me changed. Not openly, not dramatically, just enough that I noticed who stopped making eye contact. Just enough that meetings felt quieter when I spoke. Word travels faster than policy ever admits. The HR representative assigned to my case was professional and calm. A white German woman not much older than me. She spoke with empathy that felt practiced, but not insincere. She told me the company took matters like this very seriously. She told me confidentiality was a priority. She told me retaliation would not be tolerated. They interviewed everyone who had been present at the offsite. They pulled emails. They asked about patterns. Each time I was called in, I left feeling drained and oddly hollow. I was reliving moments that others had never noticed, translating sensations into sentences, watching them flatten into notes on a screen. What unsettled me most was how often I was asked to clarify tone. Not content, but tone. How did it feel? How did I interpret it? Could there be another explanation? I understood the necessity of thoroughness, but I began to feel as though my experience was being reframed as perception rather than event. Meanwhile, he continued working as usual. His calendar remained full, his authority intact. No one told him to step back or adjust behavior. No interim measures were put in place. The investigation existed alongside normal operations, like a parallel universe that never quite intersected with reality. Colleagues started asking indirect questions, not about what happened, but about how I was doing. Their concern carried an edge of caution, as if they were measuring how close they could stand without being pulled in. A few shared their own stories quietly, always ending with the same sentence. Nothing ever came of it. I began to understand the real function of the investigation. It wasn't about truth. It was about containment. About demonstrating due diligence without destabilizing hierarchy. About producing a conclusion that could be defended if challenged, not one that would change anything. When HR finally presented their findings, the language was meticulous and bloodless. They acknowledged inconsistencies. They acknowledged discomfort. They acknowledged that certain behaviors could be interpreted as inappropriate. They did not find sufficient evidence of policy violation. He was advised to be more mindful. He was reminded of professional boundaries. There would be no formal action. I sat there listening, nodding, feeling something close over inside me. I realized that every choice I had made to be careful, to be measured, to be reasonable, had been used to soften the outcome. The absence of witnesses became neutrality. The lack of physical escalation became ambiguity. His status became credibility. HR thanked me again for coming forward. They asked if I needed support. They told me my feedback would help improve processes. They asked if I felt comfortable continuing in my role. What I wanted to say was that comfort was no longer relevant. That the ground had shifted in a way I couldn't reverse. Instead, I said I needed time. Nothing in my job description changed, but everything else did. I became hyper-aware of how decisions were discussed behind closed doors. I noticed how often he was praised for leadership, how easily his narrative reasserted itself. I watched as the investigation faded into memory, mentioned only in compliance reports and internal metrics. I stayed because leaving felt like confirmation that I had been the problem. I stayed because I had invested years of my life there. I stayed because starting over felt heavier than enduring. But staying came with a cost that no one acknowledged. I no longer trusted the language we used. Words like safety and integrity sounded hollow. Meetings felt performative. Every time HR sent out a reminder about reporting concerns, my chest tightened. I knew now what those reminders were worth. He never addressed what happened. He didn't need to. The system had done that for him. Our interactions became impeccably professional, almost sterile. That distance was framed as respect. To me, it felt like erasure. I noticed how carefully others watched me after that, as if I had become a risk factor, as if proximity to my experience might complicate their own trajectories. I learned how silence spreads, how it disguises itself as neutrality. The investigation that went nowhere taught me something I wish I hadn't learned so clearly. That process can be used as a shield. That listening does not equal believing. That staying is not the same as being safe. I am still there, technically. I do my work. I deliver results. I smile when required. But part of me remains in that conference hotel lounge, standing up too late, realizing that the truth doesn't always lose because it's weak. Sometimes it loses because it's inconvenient. And once you understand that, you never walk through a workplace the same way again.